Dawood bowed deeply three times, backing away as he did so. The fool! Name of God, if one uncouth old Sioux is enough to make the man drop his court phrasing, maybe Abdullah's right. Raun escorted Dawood to the palace gates in silence. He led Dawood to a small, secluded courtyard with a tiny fountain and waved away a solitary guardsman. When they were alone, the square-shaped man let out a breath and threw up his hands.
"Ah, you see how things stand, Uncle," the captain said. "Truth be told, this sort of recklessness is rampant now. The watchman."
The man trailed off, clearly aching to relieve himself of his thought burden, but reluctant to do so. Dawood encouraged him.
"With apologies for knowing that which I ought not, Captain, I have heard that there is tension between the guard and the watch."
Raun spoke half to himself.
"Look, in every city there will be watchmen who harass blacksmiths' daughters and knock down old men for a few coins or a laugh. But there is cruelty, and there is cruelty. There is corruption, and there is corruption. People can no longer afford to pay the taxes we are asking. Too many are finding their way into the jail, far too many. And every debtor imprisoned, even for a fortnight, is a recruit for that preening traitor Farad Esemez."
"Indeed,"
Dawood agreed.
"And then there is the thief purging. Here in the palace matters legal and martial fall to me. But in the streets, the captain of the watch rules. And he was appointed because he has never in his life balked at a chance to bully. This new drive to wipe out pickpocketry is madness. There will be a lot more one-handed men in Damsawat before it is through. The last amputation I saw was of a boy of 10 years. But at least the boy only lost his hand. Too many men have been made to kneel on the executioner's leather mat of late."
"I," Dawood said, "I'd heard about the boy who was to be executed before the Falcon Prince."
Raun's expression turned dangerous.
"The bastard's name is Farad Esemez, Uncle. He's not a prince. Anyway, incidents like that are driving good men away from the guard and the watch. A fortnight ago, my second in command, Hami Samad, a man born and raised in this palace, and as steadfast a man as I've ever met, left the guard, abandoning his duties without saying a word to anyone."
Raun knuckled his mustache and sighed, fatigue overtaking his features.
"Well, I am sorry to have added to your troubles. The Caliph was not happy with you for bringing me before him."
Raun waved a dismissing hand at Dawood's apology, but there was real worry in the captain's eyes. He frowned, and his brow knitted even tighter.
"What is going on, Dawood? Whatever the Caliph's flatterers think, I know you would not be here if there was not dire reason."
"And there is, my friend. The servants of the traitorous angel are at work. But I don't know much more than the little I've told you. As soon as I learn more, I will let you know, Captain, I swear it."
Raun gave him a long look.
"Very well, Uncle. Just be sure that you do. And I'll set my street spies a digging at these names and crimes you've told me of. I am always here at the palace, so when you wish to speak to me again, just have a guardsman summon me."
Dawood exchanged cheek kisses with the captain, then made his way back to the street. Pain raged in his muscles and bones. Too much bowing and walking. He needed rest, and more than anything on God's great earth, he needed to see his wife again.
"I could have died in there on a fool's whim."
Dawood thanked Almighty God aloud that he lived. Then he achingly made his way home. Chapter 13. Walking down Breadbaker's Byway, Abdullah passed a public fountain of once white marble. Children played in its basin, and their shrill shouts shoved their way into his ears.
"Rats!"
he huffed to himself, though he knew he'd been twice as loud and obnoxious when he was a street child. To save one child from the ghouls is to save the whole world. The professional adage came to Abdullah for the 1,000th time, but what would it cost to save the whole world? His life?
Oh God, does not a fat old man's happiness matter too?
This fight had already cost him his home. The place that he had loved for so long was ruined. Vials of powdered silver and blocks of ebonwood. The Sioux sand painting he bought in the Republic, and the Rugali divan that fit his backside so comfortably. But most of all, the books. Scroll and codex. New folio and old manuscript. Even a few books in tongues he'd once hoped to learn. Leather-bound volumes in the boxy script of the warlands to the far west. He'd only ever managed to learn to read a few of their strange barking words. Now he'd never learn more. He moved against the onrushing flow of foot traffic, making his way over the smooth, worn stones of the mainway. He was comfortable moving against the crowd. How many times had a mob of sensible men been running away from some foul monster, while foolish Abdullah and his friends ran toward the thing? Irritated anew at the thought of the things his calling made him do, he pushed his big body grumpily up the downstream of people. Another pack of children chased each other through the crowd of walkers and pack animals. The little gang threatened to careen into Abdullah, but the group split before him like a wave, half the brats flowing to either side. He reminded himself that if he didn't do his duty, more little faces like these could soon be smeared with blood, their eyes aflame and their souls stolen. In his practiced way, he kept panic from rising at the thought of the threats that were out there, unseen. Abdullah passed men from Rugobe with their neatly trimmed goatees and tight-fitting turbans. He saw Red River and Blue River Sioux. He heard the false promises of 100 hawkers, the single-stringed fiddle of a roving musician, the argument a feral-eyed, twitching man was having with himself. Unlike most sons of Dead Donkey Lane, Abdullah had seen many towns. Those folk he'd grown up around would leave the city only a handful of times in their lives. Even going to another quarter was an occasion for some of them. Abdullah, on the other hand, had seen the villages of the Sioux Republic with their low, bleached clay houses of hidden luxury. He had seen the strange mountain-hole homes of the far north, where rain froze. He'd been to the edge of Rugobe, where instead of being a character from lewd shadow-puppet plays, the ghoul hunter was respected by powerful men as an earthly agent of God, and was considered a slave of the Rugali High Sultan, if a rich and powerful slave. But this city of his for some 60 years, well, there was nothing to compare with its streets. The crowds had annoyed Abdullah all his life, but of all the places in the crescent moon kingdoms he had seen, Domsawat alone was his. And somewhere in his city, murderous monsters were preying on people. "And so, you old fart, Domsawat needs you." Rotating this truth proudly in his mind made Abdullah feel just a bit less tired. But as his sandaled feet brought him closer and closer to the house of Miri al-Musa, his fatigue returned twofold. True to the code of the ghoul hunter, Abdullah had never married. "When one is married to the ghouls, one has 3 wives already," was another of the adages of his order. He didn't know much about the old order. A few adages and invocations passed down many years ago by his teacher, old Dr. Bujelli, and learned from old books. The ghoul hunters had never been as cohesive a fraternity as the dervishes' order, and any man could wear white and claim to chase monsters. Still, over the years, Abdullah had tried to adhere to what he had learned of the ways of his ancient order. He was a permissive man in many ways, no less with himself than with others, he had to admit. But in some things, rigidity was the only way. Saying marriage vows before God would cause a ghoul hunter's caftan to soil, and it would cost him the power of his invocations. As with so many of God's painful ways, Abdullah did not know why it was so, only that it was. The crowd thinned and Abdullah strode through Little Square, his caftan billowing in the breeze. Little Square was not little at all. In fact, in all the city, it was second only to Angel's Square in size. But the name was old, from the days when Domsawat had first been built on the ruins of a Kameti city, and had only 2 squares. Long rows of brown, thorny shrubbery framed its eastern and western sides. These low desert bushes served as a back wall for the stallless, beggarish sellers who lined the square to Adula's left and his right. Little Square was a haven for the less prosperous merchants and tradesmen of the city, those too poor or too unreliable to have earned, through honest work or bribery, a real shop or stall in one of the better markets. The square was flanked by these men and women, sitting on rugs or standing beside sorry piles of goods. Adula's eyes moved up the column of half-rate cobblers and rotten vegetable sellers to his right. He cursed as he caught sight, a dozen yards ahead, of a skinny man in the white caftan of his order. He strode over and made the noise in his throat that he made when genuinely offended. Litas had once said that it sounded like he was being pleasured by a poorly trained whore. For all that he mocked Rasid's dervishhood, Adula had also pledged his life to an antiquated order that Damasawatis knew mostly from great-grandparents' tales and bawdy shadow-puppet plays. Adula had learned long ago that most men professing his life-calling were charlatans, who had bits and pieces of the proper knowledge, but had never been face-to-face with a ghoul. They used cheap magic to make their robes appear moonlight white, and took the hard-earned money of the poor, mumbling a few bogus spells and promising protection from monsters. The hairy young man with an oily smile who stood before him wore such cheap robes. He was the sort who claimed to hunt the hidden spirits supposedly behind working people's every trouble, the sort who claimed to tell the future, the rotten vegetable sellers of my order. When he was a younger man, and more defensive of the honor of his order, Adula had thought it his duty to root out such hucksters and send them packing with their robes dirtied and their noses and false charms broken. But the decades since had taught him resignation. Other charlatans would always pop up, and the people, the desperate, desperate people, would always go to them. Still, Adula took enough time now to give the fraud a long, scornful glance. They knew Adula, these men, knew him to be the last of the real thing. Was it wrong that he took some pride in that? This one, at least, had the decency to lower his eyes in shame. That such thieves thrived was sad, but it was the way of the world. Adula passed the fraud by, spitting at the man's feet instead of throwing a punch as he once would have. The fool made an offended noise, but that was all. By the time he reached Miri's tidy storefront, it was past midday. The brass-bound door was open, and standing in the doorway, Adula smelled sweet incense from iron burners and camel thorn from the hearth. For a long moment he just stood there at the threshold, wondering why in the world he'd been away from this lovely place so long. A corded forearm blocked his way, and a man's shadow fell over him. A muscular man, even taller than Adula, stood scowling before him, a long scar splitting his face into gruesome halves. He placed a broad palm on Adula's chest and grabbed a fistful of white caftan.
Ho, ho! Who's this forsaker of friends slinking back in here so shamelessly?
Despite all his dark feelings, Adula smiled.
Just another foolish child of God who doesn't know to stay put, Axeface.
He embraced Miri's trusted doorman, and the two men kissed on both cheeks.
How are you these days, uncle?
The frighteningly big man asked.
Horrible, my friend, horrible. Miserable and terrible. But we praise God anyway, eh?
Will you announce me to Miri, please?
Axeface looked uncomfortable, as if he was considering saying something he didn't want to say.
What is it?
Adula asked.
I'll announce you, uncle, and there's not a man in the world I'm happier to see pay the mistress a visit. But she isn't gonna be happy to see you. You're lucky her new boyfriend isn't here.
Adula felt his insides wither. For a moment he had no words.
What?
He finally managed.
Who?
He felt as if he'd been suddenly struck half-witted.
A new man,
Axeface said with a sympathetic shake of the head.
You know him, uncle. Handsome Mansour, they call him. Short fella, thin mustache, always smells nicer than a man should.
Adula did know the man, or at least knew of him. A preening weasel that twisted others into doing his work for him. Adula's numbness burned away in a flame of outrage.
That one! He's too young for her! Name of God, he's clearly after her money!
He gestured with one hand to the greeting room behind Axe Face.
The son of a whore just wants to get his overwashed little hands on this place! Surely, man, you must see that!
Axe Face put up his leg of lamb-sized hands as if frightened of Adula.
Hey, hey, uncle, between you and me, you know I love you. You'd make a great husband for the mistress. But you've made some damned by God stupid choice as far as that goes. Surely, man, you must see that, huh?
Axe Face poked him playfully, but Adula wasn't in the mood. At all. Seeming to sense this, Axe Face straightened to his full, monstrous height.
Look, Doctor, the bottom line is I don't see nothing Mistress Miri don't want me to see. That's how I stay well paid, well fed, and smiley as a child. But if you want to see the mistress, hold on.
Adula was announced and ushered into the large greeting room. Scant sunlight made its way through the high windows. Tall couches lined the wall opposite the door, and a few well-dressed men sat on them, each speaking to a woman. Then she was there, Miri El Musa, seller of silks and sweets, Miri of the Hundred Ears. Miri. Her thick curves jiggled as she moved, and her worn hands were ablaze with henna.
"What do you want?"
she asked him, a cold wind blowing beneath her words. Adula's irritation briefly eclipsed his longing.
You may recall, woman, that you asked for my help even after you having asked me to walk my big feet out of your life and never come back. But this is not the place for us to speak.
Miri arched an eyebrow and said nothing, but she led him to the house's tiny rear courtyard, sat him down at a small table, and brought him a tray with fruit nectar, little salt fish and pickles. She sat down beside him and waited for him to speak. But for a moment Adula just sat there, listening to the birds chirping in the courtyard's twin pear trees, and avoiding Miri's eyes. He didn't break the silence until Miri began to tap her silk-slippered foot impatiently.
I'm here, Miri, because I have learned something of your niece's killers, but not enough yet to stop them from killing others. I would like to speak to your grandnephew again, as he may have recalled something new.
Faisal is not here. Some of the girls went on a work break trip to see the new menagerie the Caliph has set up outside the city, and I thought it a good idea for him to try and forget his pains, so I sent him with them. He won't be back for a day or so.
Adula plucked up a pickle and smiled to himself at the thought of a whore's holiday to see strange beasts. Surely Miri was the only proprietor in the city who would allow such a thing. As happened so often, Miri seemed to read his thoughts. She did not seem amused.
All people who work deserve days away from their labor, Duli,
she said flatly.
And whores are people, even if my business depends on letting men forget that fact.
He would not rise to the bait.
Of course. In any case, I did not come only to speak to Faisal. I came also because Miri's hundred ears are always open, sometimes to songs the rest of us don't hear. For instance, does the name Mawawa mean anything to you? Or the name Oshodo? And what do you know of the case of Hedunawas?
Her offended expression melted away, and she took on the look of Miri, knower of many things, narrowing her smoky eyes and crinkling her nose. Miri's face, when she was trying to recall something, was the same as when she was rifling through her cabinets for a particular blouse.
Oshodo. It sounds like a northern name, perhaps. I couldn't say for sure. But Hedunawas. He was an enemy of the throne, yes, one of the many conspirators killed in the civil war.
Not quite killed, it seems,
Adula muttered, Miri gave him a perplexed look, but continued.
If I recall correctly, he was also rumored to be a child killer. Now, Mawawa... All I could tell you is that it sounds like... like Kameti hidden script.
Adula snorted.
Ha! Indeed. Though it took me a full day to have that lock click open in my mind. Sometimes, my sweet, your erudition makes me sick with jealousy.
Well, even leaving aside our difference in age, I've been hit on the head far fewer times than you, Dooley.
She deigned to smile at him, and he felt his soul warm. Adula winced theatrically, as if he'd been punched in the gut. This response to Miri's jibes had always made her laugh in the past. But instead, when she met his eyes, she let her smile slip and turned away from him. There were a thousand things he wanted to say to her when he saw that, but none of them would do any good.
How is your grandnephew faring?
He asked.
How is he faring?
Her thick braid with its streak of silver whipped as she spun to give him an incredulous glare.
How is he faring? He's broken. How else could he be after what happened to him? You see so much of this horror that you don't even see it for horror anymore. He is a boy, Dooley, a boy of 8. Not one of your suicidal fanatical friends. Not some foe of the traitorous angel.
She bit off her next words quietly.
It's this madness that drove us apart.
This time Adula's wince was not feigned. Miri had always had unhappy words for the life he led, and for the friends who shared it. But those words had never been this sharp, this scornful. She wasn't stopped by his pained face.
Look at the world around you, Dooley. 40 years you've spent in this hunting. All that death, why? What has come of it? Is the world a safe place now? A happier place?
She sank into her chair and put her face in her hands.
Merciful God, I'm sorry. Now you've upset me. What I meant to say was...
But she said nothing more.
Your niece's killers are still out there, Miri. They burned my house down.
I heard.
Of course Miri of the 100 ears had heard. Yet still she had all these hard words for him.
God protect you,
she said now. Miri and he had been closer in the days when the townhouse was new, he reflected. Much closer. She had helped him choose it. Adula said nothing for a long time. Then he started to speak, though he didn't know what he was going to say.
Miri
held up a silencing hand, and with her other, wiped away the beginnings of tears. She took a deep breath and looked at Adula. Her eyes were weary, but filled with love, and she spoke softly.
I'm sorry, Dooley. I didn't mean the things I said.
Adula had never been more tired in his life, and he tried to keep the pain out of his words.
Yes, you did.
Miri's voice was steadier now, and she twined the end of her long braid around her hand, a habit Adula had noticed long ago, a sign that she was steeling herself.
Well, yes, I did, but... I do know why you do what you do, Dooley, you...
A smile spread across her face, and she started laughing, at the same time that Adula did.
Why you do what you do, Dooley, you...
he said, imitating the funny sound of her words. They both laughed, and Adula hurt again, knowing that it would end very soon.
Why had this been his fate? Why could he not have been one of the men he often walked past in the early morning light of the markets, selling lemon jelly cubes and going home every evening to a deliciously fat wife who drenched herself in rose oil, laughing at stupid things and keeping one another warm when the night wind whipped through the windows, taking the day off to be with her and losing only a few coins in his pocket? But his job, his calling, was different. When Adula neglected his duties,
gruesome things happened in the sleep rooms of children. It wasn't fair. It wasn't. His eyes burned, and he realized that they were beginning to tear up. What is wrong with me? I'm a breath away from crying like a woman. Mistress Muriel Musa of the Hundred Ears showed the secret, defenseless self that she only ever showed late at night to him.
I am sorry, Dooley. So often I have had such hard words for what you do, and yet I am here like all the rest, begging your help for my family.
Miri's coal-lined eyes were furious and on the verge of tears. When the first few fell, Adula placed an arm around her broad shoulders and wiped them away. Being seen crying would hurt her reputation.
How long have we known each other, woman? 30 years now. Don't you worry about such things. My help is always yours. Why these tears, huh? Everything will be fine, God willing.
She sniffed once again, wiped away another tear and set her jaw.
Fine. Oh, merciful God, my niece is dead. Everything will not be fine, Dooley. Everything is going down to the Lake of Flame and the traitorous angel. But you're right. There's no point in crying, not where men can see, anyway.
With one last sniffle, she was all calmness again.
So, have you any more clues as to who or what is behind her murder?
Adula struggled to recall all that the mad creature Mawawa had revealed.
There was one thing more,
Adula said at last.
The monster I am hunting. It spoke of its master sitting on the Cobra throne. Have you ever heard of such a thing? Do you know where it might be?
Miri bit her lip and looked troubled.
I have,
she said. She took a breath, then a sip of nectar and went on.
It was years ago. After one of the Falcon Prince's first raids, all of the city's talk was on the gold and weapons he'd stolen from the old Caliph's treasure house. But my sources told me that the prince himself was most interested in a dusty old scroll he'd found.
Adula was as impressed as always with the things Miri knew, and it must have shown on his face. Miri shrugged.
Of course I was interested. I am the font of all knowledge in this city. No one in Dom Sawat would know anything if not for my spies. And books are like spies' reports frozen in amber. If the Falcon Prince wanted to know something that bad, it must have been valuable, I figured. So I had one of my ears within his organization act as eye and pen, copying as much as he could of the stolen scroll. Those were different days, of course. Farad Ez-Hemez's operation was not quite so airtight then. In any case, my spy had to use a very expensive scrivening spell, but the scroll proved useless to me. It cost an obscene amount to copy it, but the jest was on me. All but the title of the thing was in a thrice-ciphered version of hidden script. The characters were there, but pricey, pricey magics which might not have even worked were required to break the cipher spells. Wealthy as I am, I still didn't have enough to waste on trying to translate it.
Adula, growing impatient, spoke around a mouth of saltfish.
Oh, forgive me, my sweet, but I asked you about...
The Cobra Throne, that was the title of the scroll. It was about ancient Kem. But as I say, not worth the price of translating. For all I knew, it was about some old buried hoard of the pharaohs somewhere, which may or may not have ever existed, and may or may not have already been hit by grave robbers. And I'm not the sort to go funding a grave digging. Then there was the possibility that the Falcon Prince had stolen it only because the original was valuable. I didn't know, and it wasn't worth wagering further funds to find out. God's truth be told, I don't think that the gold-grubbing Caliph had ever bothered to translate it either. At least my spies at the time had heard the Falcon Prince mock this fact.
Adula snorted.
Ha! Aye, that sounds like the work of Caliphs, locking away knowledge and words without even reading them.
Why is this important, Dooley? What is going on?
Adula ignored her questions.
Please, my sweet, tell me that you still have a copy of this scroll.
Miri's offended sniff cut through her worried expression.
Have you ever known me to throw away something of potential value? Name of God, for 30 years I didn't throw you away!
Weariness overtook her smoky eyes.
Be careful here, Dooley. If the Falcon Prince is involved in this, I know you admire him, but he's a dangerous madman. And from what my ears tell me, he is furious right now about the murder of a beggar family who was under his protection. Mother, father, and daughter all found with their hearts carved out. Apparently the same fate struck a squad of his men as well.
Adula had nearly forgotten Bahim's giving him that last bit of interesting and troubling news. But he only half analyzed it now, as he was overcome with thankfulness. Whatever else was wrong in the world, God had seen fit to keep this woman in Adula's life, worrying over him. This funny, strong, bedchamber-skilled woman who loved him. Man-jackals and ghouls could not change that fact. Still, this news increased Adula's sense that Farad as Hemez might make a useful ally.
Can you put me in touch with him, Miri? It may help me put an end to these murders.
She squinted in thought for a moment, then shook her head.
Perhaps I could. But I'm sorry, Dooley, I won't. That would require my making more contact with his people, and after he killed this last headsman. No, it's just too dangerous. The man has lots of right-sounding ideas.
Miri continued.
And I must admit, he is remarkably handsome. I'd wager you didn't know that I once saw those calves very close up, did you know? Never you mind where or when.
She was trying to make Adula jealous, to upset him. It was working. He felt, not in a pleasant way, that he was a boy of 5 and 10 again.
But despite these things, she went on, he is, beneath all his pretty words, talking about civil war. Wars are bad for business, and a war inside the gates of the city? Almighty God forbid it. Do you know what happens to whores in a war, Dooley? Of course you do. I've got arson and rape on the one hand and a clinking coin purse on the other, Dooley. For me and mine, it's an easy choice. I've got a house full of innocent girls to protect here.
Adula smiled despite his frustration.
Innocent? A funny word, all things considered.
Miri did not smile back.
Yes, you damned by God oaf, innocent! My new girl, Carisse, fled her father not 3 weeks ago. What does she know of war?
Adula sighed.
Ah, well, pretty eyes. I know well enough that you won't be budged when you won't be budged, but at least tell me what your ears have heard of these murders.
Miri shrugged.
Not much. The watchmen marked it up to street folk killing street folk. The family did their alms seeking outside of Yeye's tea house, and they were found dead there, along with old Yeye himself. They...
What? Yeye! When did...
Who?
Words failed him, and his stomach sank as he watched Miri's eyes widen. She took his hands in hers.
Oh. Oh, name of God, Dooley, I'm so sorry. I'd forgotten what friends the two of you were.
Adula felt a sob begin to rise within him. He smothered it, and something within him went cold.
Yeah. Ministering angels. Yeah.
He spoke absently.
Oh, Miri, don't you see? Things can't stay safe forever, no matter who rules. You with your 100 ears know that better than most.
She sighed and nodded.
I know. But maybe they can be bearable for another few years. That's all I dare ask of God.
He ran his hand through his beard.
And then what, my sweet?
Then I'll climb warm and sleepy into my grave, God willing.
She rose and kissed his forehead. Then she went in search of the scroll she had mentioned, leaving Adula alone with birdsong, the scent of pear trees, and thoughts of his dead friend.
Dead.
May God shelter your soul, you cross-eyed old rascal.
He recalled Yeye's words of a few days ago, before Faisal, before the giant ghoul, before Zamia, before Mawawa, before he was killed.
May all merciful God put old men like us quietly in our graves.
The tea-house owner had no family that Adula knew of. Likely the watchman had already tossed his body in the charnel commons. Adula thought about going to his own grave alone. And then he thought, as he had not allowed himself to while Miri was before him, of the words Axeface had said just an hour ago. Her new man. When she returned a few minutes later, handing him a scroll case, he found he couldn't quite keep his thoughts to himself.
What's this I hear about handsome Mansour spending his time around here? Everyone in the street knows the fool is too cheap to be an honest customer to you.
She stared at him then, and her face took on the angriest look Adula had ever seen her wear.
May God damn you, Dooley,
she said in a near whisper.
May God damn you for daring to be jealous.
Something cruel grew in her eyes.
Do you want to know the truth? Do you? Well, I will tell you. Yes, Mansour has been spending his time with me, praise be to God. And praise be to God. Last night he asked me to marry him.
Last night, when I was busy learning about a living dead killer and his master. And what did you say?
Adula heard some man somewhere ask with a weak voice like his.
That is none of your damned by God business. Unless you are prepared to compete for my hand.
Adula felt the familiar pain of having no good answers for the person on God's great earth he cared most about.
Oh, pretty eyes. I know you don't want to hear this, but there are ways other than a formal marriage before God. We could live...
Lake of flame, do you think because of what I do for a living that I am completely bereft of virtue?
Miri's eyes tightened.
Well, I'm not. And what is a woman's greatest chance at showing her virtue in marriage?
I know that you possess a thousand virtues, Miri.
Adula meant every word, but Miri just threw up her hennaed hands in exasperation.
Oh, no. No more of that damned by God sugar talk. It's been many years since I could keep myself warm at night remembering your words while you were nowhere to be found. My niece is dead, Dooley. It is a reminder from Almighty God. I've got a good 20 years left in this world, if God wills it. Thousands of days, thousands of nights. I'm not going to spend them all alone. I'm not.
She fell silent, gazing up into the tree branches. When he looked at the line of her broad neck, the sand-brown skin smooth despite her near 50 years, he felt like he would weep. Adula kneaded the flesh of his forehead with his knuckles, trying to somehow rouse the right words. He kept picturing Yeye, who had always said that marriage was a fool's move. Dead. Yeye was dead. Perhaps Miri was right. Perhaps there was some message from God to be found in these murders. About priorities. About what was left of his own life. Adula stared at his hands. If he and his friends found this Orshado, this ghoul of ghouls, and defeated him, then what? Would God's great earth be purged of all danger? Would the traitorous angel servants all just go away? Oh, when would Adula's work be done? He'd asked himself the question many times, but today he faced the honest answer for perhaps the first time in 40 years. His work would end only when he was dead, or when he ended it. He swallowed hard, and looked up from his hands.
Miri.
Yes,
she said, her voice flat.
This is it, my sweet.
I cannot let a man who has murdered my friend and your niece stalk this city any longer. But if I live through this, that's it for me then. I'm done. Men can find someone else to save them from the ghouls.
Miri rolled her eyes, the hardness he knew so well returning to her voice.
Do you want me to do a little dance? I mean, I've only heard that 10 times before, Dooley. Don't you think I know by now that such declarations are just words on the air? They'll be blown away by the first strong breeze that comes along.
Adula swallowed again and took hold of Miri's shoulders, giving her the most level look he could.
Not this time.
He found himself speaking formal words that he'd never said, not in 30 years of half-meant promises.
I swear this to you, O Miri al-Musa, in the name of God the All-Hearing, who witnesses all oaths, in the name of God the Most Honest, who loves truth and not lies, I swear to you that when this is done I will return here. And if my fate is so kind that you haven't yet married this money-grubbing fop, I swear in the name of God the Great Father that I will touch my forehead to the ground before you and beg you to marry me.
He knew that she understood what such an oath meant to him, but Adula also knew that Miri lived in a world of oath-shatterers. He expected more scornful skepticism. But Miri al-Musa just stood there, eyes shining, lip trembling, looking as lovely as the day Adula had met her. And she said not a word. Hours later he found himself walking wearily back into Dawood and Lita's greeting room. The Sioux couple sat on a divan speaking quietly. Rasid sat cross-legged on the floor, engaging in one of his breathing exercises, but the pallet where Zamia had been recuperating was empty. A good sign. His friends looked up as he entered.
"What news?" Dawood asked. "Did the boy have anything new to tell?"
"The boy?"
Adula asked, confused for a moment.
"Oh, him. A little Faisal. He was not there, as it happens, but—"
he said, brandishing the scroll Miri had given him.
"Miri al-Musa gave me this, which may hold some answers for us. What of you, brother of mine? How went your meeting with Raun Haddad?"
Litaz answered for her husband.
"Dawood managed not to get himself killed by the defender of virtue himself, and to give a vague warning, but that is about all. But tell us, how is Miri?"
Adula frowned, sensing the subtle edge beneath the alchemist's words.
"Please, my dear, none of your snobbish scorn for the whole mistress, eh? Of all days, not today."
Dawood snorted.
You forget that my beloved wife is, even after decades in Damsawat, a slightly prudish Blue River girl at heart."
Litaz's eyes filled with half-serious lividity.
"Prudish? You of all people, husband, know that—"
"He said slightly prudish,"
Adula pointed out with a smile, feeling buoyed a bit by the presence of his bantering friends. Litaz rolled her eyes.
"You know it has nothing to do with that, my friend. We just want better for you. It's all we've ever wanted. I have no problem with what Miri is, but she won't let you be what you are. So I've been squawking this tune for near 20 years, so what? It's as true today as it was 12 years ago. There are women, younger women, pretty women, who would be able to live realistically with the white kaftan you wear."
Adula plopped down onto a brocaded stool and let out a loud sigh.
"Ah, even if that were true, my dear, it wouldn't matter."
For a long while the room was silent, save for the soft sounds of Rasid's inhalations and exhalations. Then Adula heard himself say,
"She is going to marry another. At least another man has asked for her hand. A younger man."
Dawood gave him a look of loving sympathy. Litaz stood, walked over and took his big hands in her tiny ones. She squeezed, smiled sadly, said nothing. Rashid, finally looking up from his exercises, spoke confusedly.
Doctor, I don't understand.
You and your understanding can go down to the Lake of Flame, boy. Now shut up! We have more important things to discuss. Where is the tribeswoman, anyway? Off stalking the city for gazelles?
I'm here, Doctor,
Samia said, emerging from the back of the house where she'd no doubt been making water. Adula noted that she walked more or less steadily on her feet, and that much of the weakness he'd seen in her only last night was gone.
Did you learn anything that will help avenge my band?
To his surprise, Adula found that he could not speak of Yaya's murder.
It was foolish, he knew. These were his closest friends in the world, and allies who needed all of the information they could get.
But Adula thought of Litaz trying to find drops of Yaya's blood, or some such, or trying to analyze the angle at which his heart had been ripped out. And he felt that his own soul would somehow snap if he did not keep this one bit of grimness to himself for now. So as his friends and allies listened, Adula instead recounted what little else Miri had known, and told them about the thrice-ciphered hidden script scroll that spoke of the Cobra Throne.
Though all merciful God alone knows how we're going to unravel these cipher spells, the costs and the expertise involved.
He trailed off, exhausted and daunted by just about everything in his life. Litaz shot a worried look in her husband's direction.
Actually, I do know of one man who might have the skill and inclination to help us with this, and he would do it quickly if I asked.
Dawood's expression was perplexed, then bitter.
Him! Well, I have no doubt that that one will be all too ready to help. He will be falling all over himself to give you what you need. At a price.
Adula smiled.
Yasir the spellseller, of course. It seems then that I am not the only one fated by God to get help from an old heart's flame.
Litaz sighed.
Ah, he will gouge us, but will do so less severely than others would. And he'll do honest and discreet work. If I send a messenger now, I should be able to see him by tomorrow.
By all means, send a messenger, and you should take the boy with you tomorrow.
Both Litaz and Rashid started to speak, but Adula cut them both off.
I know, you can take care of yourself,
he said, gesturing with one hand toward Litaz.
And your place is protecting me, or Zamia, or whomever you've decided duty dictates today,
he continued, gesturing with his other hand toward Rashid.
But between Dawood and Zamia, and myself, we can, almighty God willing, handle any threat that might strike here. You'll be carrying a great deal of coin, Litaz. And even aside from that, the more I think on it, the less comfortable I am with any of us being alone out there.
Indulge me, eh?
With that, Adula walked off and made water before dragging himself to the makeshift bed his friends had set for him. He was exhausted, but he could not stop thinking about Yeye. And about Miri. The choice she had made. The oath Adula himself had made. Miri's words, thousands of days, thousands of nights, echoed in his head, as did Yeye's words about old men and graves. Sleep was a long time in coming. Chapter 14. There was a clean tang to the late morning air, and Rashid, Bes Rashid, breathed it in deeply as he made his way toward the north inner gate. Litaz, daughter of Likami, walked a half step in front of him, dressed more richly than Rashid had ever seen. Her long dress was embroidered with amethyst gem thread. She wore rings of gold and coral in her twist locks, and a jewel-pommeled dagger sheathed in dyed kidskin on her belt.
Is she expecting a fight?
Rashid resolved to be even more watchful than usual. The inn where they were meeting Litaz's contact was in the round city, the innermost part of Damsawat. A 60-foot wall of massive sun-dried bricks surrounded the round city, with great gates of iron in its northern and southern sections. The pair joined a line of people making their way through the north inner gate, and in a short time reached the gate itself. As they walked through, Litaz smiled and nodded at one of the watchmen on duty. The man eyed Rashid's habit and sword, but said nothing. As soon as they passed through the gate, they turned from the huge gray paving stones of the mainway. Litaz led the way confidently, and Rashid followed. They rounded a corner and stepped onto Goldsmith's Row, a paved lane that was narrower than the mainway, but still quite broad. Leaving behind the press of pedestrians and shouting porters already building up, the pair joined a traffic flow that was decidedly quieter and less crowded. Litaz bit her lower lip and mumbled to herself, obviously deep in thought. So Rashid remained silent and took in his surroundings. He had been in Damsawat for nearly 2 years now, but he'd never been down Goldsmith's Row. He looked about with interest. Tidy storefronts and splendid houses lined the street here. The crude, open stone windows of the scholars' quarter replaced by fine sandalwood screens, and in the more opulent shops, leaded glass. Though one could walk here from the scholars' quarter in less than an hour, the two neighborhoods were a world apart. Here were the homes and shops of Abyssin's wealthiest merchants and most distinguished craftsmen. Elite importers and perfumers, gem cutters and jewelers, bookbinders and glassblowers. Here also, in decadently furnished mansions, lived the courtiers and viziers and their families, those who did not live at the palace itself. Rashid marveled at how few people there were, and what little noise they made. No doubt many of them were home preparing meals for the Feast of Providence, which was this evening. But there was more to it than that, Rashid thought. This was the sort of place where one could be alone with one's meditations. The streets of the scholars' quarter were never this quiet, or this empty, or this clean. Rashid envied the residents the solemnity of their surroundings.
No great stinking puddles, no loud donkey whipping, no hashish smoke drifting in the window, no muttering madmen. Would that I had a place like this to meditate and train.
He tried to smother this unacceptable covetousness.
O believer, worship God wherever fate finds thee, whether prison, prairie, or prayer's day table,
the heavenly chapters say. His service with the doctor did not bring him into contact with the overfed inhabitants of the Round City. It was probably just as well. The denizens of the doctor's home quarter disgusted Rashid with their degeneracy and lewdness. But while the hashish smokers and whores of the scholars' quarter were foul, the men and women here were perhaps even more foul. Here was wealth, as much wealth as anywhere in the Crescent Moon Kingdoms. Here was every opportunity for virtue and learning, with none of the dire incitements to vice that poverty brought. But the doctor claimed that the people of Goldsmith's Row ignored such opportunity, using their incalculable riches only to devise new and more luxuriant vices. Partner, he had called Rashid the other night. But Rashid was unworthy. He'd said nothing to the doctor or the others about his encounter with Farad Ezhemez, about taking the stolen goods the thief had given him. He hadn't gone so far as to utter a falsehood. When he'd returned to the Sioux couple's shop, and Litaz had asked after his dusty silks and disheveled appearance, he'd put off her questions, and she hadn't pressed him. The wrongness of it burned his soul, like a foretaste of the lake of flame. Partner. Again he turned the word over in his mind. Unworthy though he was to speak prayers to God, he prayed now that the doctor was safe. There was no telling when that Mauawa creature would strike again.
Rashid,
Litas's voice intruded on his thoughts.
Yes, auntie.
He scanned the thin crowd about them as he answered.
Zamia Benuleth Bedoui. She is interested in you. Do you see this? Do you understand how careful you must be with this?
He felt as if she had slapped him. Without meaning to, he stopped walking. He closed his hand around his sword hilt, said nothing, and started walking again. Litaz's heart-shaped face split in a patronizing smile as she walked beside him.
And you have taken an interest in her, too. Anyone with eyes can see that plainly enough,
she said, sounding amused. He began to dispute the alchemist's words, but found that he could not quite do so without speaking a falsehood, which was forbidden by the traditions of the order. He tried to find something to say, but all that he could come up with were questions.
With most humble apologies, Auntie, you should not say such things, he said at last.
She's a Bedouin Rasid. Even as she is fixed on revenge, she will be thinking about keeping her band from dying out.
Litas's smile deepened. It was the smile of one who knew more than Rasid did about certain matters, and he found that it upset him. He kept walking, keeping his gaze straight ahead, hoping to force an end to the conversation. But Litas continued.
It's all right, you know. What you feel when you look at her. You've been holding a sword so long that you've known little else. But there is nothing wrong with what you feel when you look at her.
The Sioux people had a frankness in speaking of things inappropriate. It was not surprising that the doctor was so comfortable among them. Rasid felt his face flush, and he bit off his words.
You speak of such things too openly, he said,
and surely none could blame him if he was more curt than one ought to be with an elder. But if annoyance was edging into his voice, it was annoyance with himself as much as anything. He wanted to be comforted, despicably weak as he was. He wanted to reach out to Litas and talk to her about these things, but that was simply unacceptable. He fell silent. She smiled gently.
If you want to talk, young man, I swear before God that I'll not say a word to anyone, not even to Adula or my husband.
They moved on, turning off of Goldsmith's Row to enter a neat but narrow cobblestone alleyway. Something in his soul clenched and then relaxed. He felt the words come without his bidding them.
I don't have any secrets, Auntie. It is just that she has been chosen by the angels themselves. I wish that it is so difficult sometimes. When I went to seek the Crimson Quicksilver, I—
You will do best to answer quickly, Hollett, and truthfully.
The harsh voice came to Rasid's ears at the same time that the speaker, a robed man with a whip, came into his field of vision. The man was lean and gray-haired, and two big men with short, thin clubs stood with him. These other two might have been twins, both young, huge, and hook-nosed. All three men were clean-shaven and wore plain turbans and heavy robes of brown sackcloth belted with coarse rope. They had a girl trapped in the alley. The humble students, wandering mendicants that scoured wickedness from the streets and taverns of the Crescent Moon Kingdoms. Rasid felt even worse than he had a moment before. He glanced at Litas. Her smile had twisted into a hard line. She looked more the old warrior than the kind grandmother now. The humble students were charged with chastising those who needed to be chastised, helping men and women to walk the path of God. But Rasid had learned that some humble students did this more out of greed or cruelty than righteousness. Praised in Rugalbah, mocked in the Sioux Republic, in Damsawa'at the students were few in number, tolerated by the Khalifs, disliked by the people. Unsurprisingly, Rasid's mentor was among their despisers.
I don't trust anyone who claims to serve God by beating up dancers and drunks, the doctor had growled once.
The trio stood shoulder to shoulder 20 yards down the cobbled alley. They were facing Rasid and Litas's direction. Their gazes, however, were set on a girl wearing a gauzy blouse and tight leggings with pale laces. Rasid picked up the cloying smell of cheap oil of violet from the slender girl, far away though she was. Trouble, the dervish knew. As he stood surveying the scene, Litas shot forward. The students and the girl all locked eyes on her.
What is the matter here?
Litas's voice was bold, and it instantly agitated the students. The gray-haired leader frowned.
The matter? An unclean girl is to be shown the way of God. Do you wish to watch and learn from her example, outlander? The Republic is a decadent place. The Sioux more than most would benefit from our lessons.
There was no emotion but scorn in the man's voice. Litas flashed a caustic smile.
I've seen the students' lessons before, brother. I'm afraid I can't say that I always approve of them.
The man arched an eyebrow.
Watch yourself, woman. We do not need the approval of outlanders. We found the tramp going about her foul business in plain view. The whorehouses of this city have been left to fester, and now their rotted fruit spills onto respectable streets. But if the watchmen will not do their duty, we will do it for them. 10 lashes is the punishment.
Leather creaked as the man flexed his whip. The girl jumped in, sensing her chance.
I wasn't working on the street, Auntie, I swear it. I wouldn't do that. I was just coming from a friend's house.
The girl lowered her eyes in shame.
She can't be more than 4 and 10,
Rashid thought, disgusted. But he felt something shameful, painfully shameful, race through his body as he looked at her.
What is your name, girl?
Litaz asked. The girl looked at the alchemist with hunted gazelle eyes.
Suri?
A look of surprise crossed Litaz's face.
Suri? Truly? That is one you don't hear every day.
The girl made a noise in her throat and ducked her head.
Suri,
Litaz repeated.
A beautiful name and a very, very old one.
She turned to the students with a clearly forced smile.
Surely you brothers see the sign from Almighty God here? The heavenly chapter story of Suri says, O headsman, drop your sword and serve his mercy. O flogger, drop your whip and serve his mercy.
The gray-haired student spread a conciliatory hand, but he sneered as he did so.
The chapters also say, and yea, proper punishment is the sweetest mercy, do they not? A new era is coming, outlander, an era when only those who walk the path prescribed will prosper.
The two big men were tensed for a fight. Rashid found that he was as well. He took a step toward Litaz.
The path prescribed? And the students will be the ones to judge what that is?
The alchemist's eyes narrowed as she spoke.
Please, let the girl go. I ask you to indulge an old woman.
When this earned no response, Litaz's pleading slid into threat.
Look. We are not on the River Docks, brothers. Do you think the respectable people of this neighborhood, who you know can't stand your order anyway, do you think they will sit idly by while you beat a girl in their streets?
The eldest student's sneer deepened. He ran a hand over his smooth brown jaw.
Listen to me, woman. Leave now. Please. Do you see? I say please. Go back to one of your perverted outlander neighborhoods. I will not ask you again.
He turned his head toward Rashid.
And you, Master Dervish?
The man's brittle-sounding voice made the title a mockery, but for the first time he looked unsure of himself.
Are you truly keeping company with this trash?
Rashid parted his lips. But no sound came out. Words flew into his head.
I am here in company with her, but please forgive her, brother. I am afraid that I must...
But none of them made it through his suddenly dry and cracked throat. Rashid had faced and killed highwaymen, cyclop and ghoul, but he now found himself paralyzed and unable to speak. The gray-haired man's uncertain expression evaporated, replaced by a cold scowl.
I take it by your silence that you are here with this mad old degeneress. Where is your virtue? Have you stopped serving God already, young man?
The two big hook-nosed men began to shift, clearly itching for a fight. There was the incongruous sound of laughter as two young couples entered the alley, took one look at the scene before them, and swiftly turned back. Litaz drew her dagger from the kidskin sheath at her waist.
What is she doing?
Long and broad-bladed, in her little hand it was a small sword.
Leave, Suri,
the alchemist said with a deadly calm in her voice. When the girl didn't move, Litaz shouted,
Leave! Now!
The girl ran before the men could grab her. The two big students started to follow, but their leader held up a hand and they froze. Suri flew from the alley without a word or a backward glance.
This old whore's vice is greater than the other's was.
The lead student spoke to his men with an eerie calm.
She will take the girl's punishment.
He focused his words on Litaz.
And who are you, whore with a knife, to think you can interfere in God's work with impunity?
The man seemed genuinely curious. Litaz gave no answer. The veins in the man's neck bulged.
Whoever you will find that you are sorely mistaken.
Rossi did not approve of the man's tone. There was an unvirtuous anticipation there at the thought of proving Litaz mistaken in some brutal manner. Rasid's hand went to the hilt of his sword before he thought about who his opponents were. The order held ties with the humble students. These men might be unpleasant and overbearing, but they were Rasid's allies as far as duty was concerned.
But
Litaz, daughter of Likami, was a true servant of God, who had doubtless fought more real battles than all three of these men combined. And she was one of the doctor's dearest friends. Rasid's mind raced, and his hand flexed on his pommel. Litaz broke the silent moment.
The father of the universe does not tell us to beat frightened girls, brother. Can your kind find no other way in which to spread virtue?
One of the big men began to slap his club against his open palm. He moved two steps closer to Litaz. The men were nearly in swinging range now, and Rasid took two long strides closer. The gray-haired man shot Rasid a warning look, then spoke more calmly to Litaz.
Such rude words. Come, woman. Old and withered or young and hale, all must live by his words. Come and be chastised. It will be quick and feather light for one so small as you. I swear in the name of God.
Litaz laughed a bitter little laugh.
Come try and chastise me, brother. You'll end up lying in the street.
Everything happened at once. The two hook-nosed students lurched at Litaz. They were not fighting men. That was clear enough to Rasid. No need for his sword. He blocked the assailant closest.